Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today has produced a work that's been described as a must-read, the best non-fiction book of the year, bar none. It's been likened to The Wealth of Nations for the 21st century. It's a book which outlines a different and better way of living for individuals, for communities, for businesses, and for the planet. The author's been named one of Time's 100 most influential people, Fast Company's Fast 50 innovators, and Business Week's top 10 designers. Robin Chase, welcome to the show. Now, we've all heard of Airbnb and Uber. They're examples of the sharing economy, and I know we'll come back to that. It's a word you don't like. But a full decade before those companies started, Robin started Zipcar, and out of that move came this extraordinary book. It's called Peers Incorporated. So, Robin, I'd like to take you back to the beginning. At the time, the press loved the line, Boston mother of three becomes global transport entrepreneur. But it was a little bit less simplistic than that, wasn't it?
I did laugh at that line. It's true, I am a mother of three. But I thought, I'm not quite like every other mother of three. I feel like I'm incredibly well-educated. I have a business degree from MIT. My father was an American diplomat, so I grew up around the world and lived in many major cities around the world and saw different lifestyles and had a lot of freedom as a child. I'm just thinking about founding Zipcar, where my love of transportation and autonomy and being able to go places on the fly easily, I think it came from an incredibly fantastic life throughout the Middle East, being the fifth of six children, where I think by the time they got to child number five, I had a lot of freedom that Parents' Day might not let happen. So when I moved to the U.S. and was raising my family in Boston, I have a co-founder who is German, and she was sitting in a cafe in Berlin, and she looked across the street and she saw a shared car. This was back in the fall of 1999, and we met in the cafe, and she told me the idea, and I joke, and I think it's true, a light bulb went on over my head, and I said, whoa, this is what the internet is made for, sharing a very specific resource easily among lots of people. This is what wireless will make possible, so we can send the reservation from the server, the internet, directly to the car to unlock the door. And this is what I personally really want. I have these three children and a husband, and I live in a dense urban area, and there was no way I wanted to own my own car. I just wanted one sometimes. So I tell entrepreneurs and people who want to be entrepreneurs, I do think we are all the right person for something, that it builds on your life's experience. And certainly that's how I felt about Zipcar, that I really was the right person to hear that concept at that moment, and it really spoke to me. What Zipcar did that was so dramatically different from the countries in Europe that had been building it for a while, building car sharing, was that we used the technology at hand to completely make the experience different, and we rebranded it. It was not a cooperative, community, low-tech, kind of crummy service, that I really wanted to brand it and deliver on something that was incredibly fast, easy, convenient. And I would say that, you know, our branding was, if you were a financially smart urban insider, this is obviously what you would do. And just referencing Uber, which I laugh, you know, that people say, oh, you know, that app, it's like magic. Well, so when we launched Zipcar, you could get a car in 30 seconds, the same magic, 15 years sooner. And yet we didn't have smartphones then. In Boston, 25% of the population had a cell phone when they started, and only 50% of the people had access to the internet, which was primarily at work.
Which is extraordinary.
What a different time, isn't it?
Yeah.
But one of the reasons we succeeded is because I really didn't know how hard it was and how forward-thinking it was, that in the venture capital community, everyone was talking about wireless, 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 as if there were things that were happening. And now I look and I think, oh, you know, there was actually only two wireless consumer devices. One would be a radio that you would listen to, and one were these mobile phones. And so Zipcar was really wireless application number three that was for individuals, for people. And it took a long time before we had any other use of that. And now you're reminding me, I once testified before Congress on this point. We were talking about the oligopoly of telecommunications companies. When Zipcar launched in 2000, data plans did not exist. The idea of people using data was not a thing. And they wanted to charge us for each car as if it was its own cell phone, even though the amount of data passing between the server and the car was 1/1,000,000th of what you would use for a cell data plan. And so we were 3 years before data plans were created.
Quite extraordinary. Now, again, harking back to some of that early coverage, you know, to mother of three and so on, starting company with $68 in the bank account. How did you fund it?
So I was just giving a talk to entrepreneurs the other day, and here's a metaphor that I used to talk about all the time. So my favorite image is picture that you are a bunch of puppies in a box, right? All the startups are little puppies in a box. And angel investors will come up and they'll reach down and they'll choose you, and you're wagging your tail wildly, and they pick you up and they say, oh, you're so cute. You're just such a great idea. It's so wonderful. And then they put you back down in the box and they don't choose you. And you are every day working so hard at trying to get yourself funded. And every day you are not funded. And I remember thinking, what do you think that we're growing on? You know, it's just, and for the investors, it's no risk for them. Every day they don't give you any money is another day less risk. And so raising money for Zipcar was absolutely one of the hardest parts of the whole process. And then the day that you are a grown puppy and you're so tall that you're teetering on the edge of that cardboard lip with your big fat belly and ready to fall out by yourself, then they say, oh, we'll choose you and we'll invest you in you. But it was, so my first investor was a classmate from MIT who was the first of my business school classmates to become a millionaire. I had investors that were, my former boss was an investor. Classmates who heard about Zipcar on the radio were investors. Some very small venture funds were investors. And I felt that it was a really great mix because it was people who knew me personally and people who loved the idea and had never, ever met me, and a very, very small amount of family and friends.
And there was a bit of a financial screw-up, though, near the beginning.
Yeah, so I raised this $50,000 from my first friend. And so we spent that money on technology. I'm not an engineer. And the most amazing part about Zipcar is that we, from incorporation of the company to launch of the first car, was 6 months. And we only raised $75,000, launched within 6 months, and I'm not an engineer. And I look at that, and that was 15 years ago, where the internet was way harder to work with. And it really feels very miraculous today, and I've never been able to repeat that. We had one Volkswagen Beetle, that was a lime green Volkswagen Beetle, that was our beta car running around the city. And that's what we were testing with 22 people who were paying customers on that one car. And 3 days before we were going to launch the service, I had been negotiating with a leasing company for about a month, and they were going to deliver 3 more cars to make our launching fleet a total of 4 cars. And the lessor called up and said, oh, by the way, we need $7,000 deposit for each of these cars. And at that time, we had $68 of the $50,000 left in our bank account. And so I needed $21,000 or else we would not be launching. And so it was a terrible afternoon. That evening, I had been planning to go to a launch party of another startup, and I went to it at 6 and was crowded with people, and I only knew one person, and it was an angel investor I had been talking with, and he only knew me. So he came over, and this is honestly the entire conversation. He said, Robin, how are you? How's Zipcar going? What can I do to help? And I said, I need $25,000 by tomorrow morning. And he said, done. And literally the next morning at 9 a.m., we called the bank and the wire had happened, and I sent the money to the leasing company, and we launched 2 days later.
Amazing. And Zipcar still going strong. Now, remind me, Avis made an offer for it. How much?
I think Avis bought it for $500 million, so $500 million. Previously, we had gone public. And so I joke that when you're building a business plan and raising money, you always have to talk about the exit strategy. How will investors get their money out? And you always, and I feel like, why do we have to tell you this? It's always one of two things. Either you'll go public or you'll get bought. And Zipcar managed to do both. We went public and then we got bought.
Amazing. Now, of course, what it's all built on is excess capacity. And that really is at the heart of this fabulous book. Tell us about why you wrote the book.
So after I did Zipcar and as I was watching lots of innovations happen and unfold, I started to really understand and look at it. I feel like this was an unfolding to me too. Like, what is it that we had succeeded at? Why was Flickr successful? What was really happening with Facebook or Twitter or eBay? And I was looking at these companies and I was thinking, oh, you know, they all really are based on this idea of excess capacity. So if you think about, let's go to the most obvious ones, all the ones I mentioned, but if we go to the most obvious that everyone's talking about today, Uber and Airbnb, these are platforms that are harnessing excess capacity and inviting the participation of a diversity of people, I think of as peers, to come in. And when you work with excess capacity, which is something that already exists, it's already been paid for, but there's more value there. So my car that I already own, my house that has a spare room, or the photographs I've already taken, or the junk in my basement. All of these are excess capacity. And it means that the economics has already been paid for. So the economics of using that is completely transformed. It makes what you're doing vastly cheaper than it otherwise would be. So with Zipcar, we leveraged excess capacity because previous to the invention of Zipcar, people had two ways to buy a car, which was buy a whole car. It costs about 6,000 euros a year, yet they only use it 5% of the time. So the second most expensive thing that people buy is idle 95% of the time. Or people were forced to do car rental, which comes in these 24-hour bundles, even if you want it for 2 hours or for 26 hours. And so both ways that you are allowed to consume a car, you're always forced to buy more than you wanted. So I knew that the economics of that proposition were, if I let you pay just for the hour, it would be vastly cheaper than your other alternatives. And so similarly, for all of these, if Uber had to buy hundreds of thousands of cars and find those drivers around the world, it would be impossible for them to start the company. And Airbnb would never be able to build a worldwide global hotel chain in 4 years, matching the largest hotel chain in the world, if it had to create that from scratch, from land on the ground. So it's leveraging this excess capacity that changes the economics, transforms the speed at which you can do things, and opens up the potential for a huge amount more value. I've been talking about physical assets because they are ones that are so easy for us to quickly come to mind. But think about LinkedIn is a company that is based on the excess capacity, the additional value that can be extracted out of my personal networks. Or we can think about the open data movement where governments or transportation agencies open up their data that they've collected for themselves, that they've used, that they were happy with, and they open it up on a platform called Open APIs. And trillions of dollars of value worldwide are being extracted through new ways of recombining these government data that was sitting there always. So it's this latent value. And let's talk about your smartphone and apps. I think of the smartphone as a platform, and all of those apps are leveraging the purchase that you already made. You bought your phone for maybe 4 or 5 killer apps. And then all these other ones are free riders on this device that's your device. I was in China the other day giving an hour-long news show on the sharing economy, and the TV anchor was warming up the studio audience, and I just loved this moment. So he said to them, he says, okay, who among you would share your houses? And everyone raises their, most people raise their hands. Who would share their cars? And most people are raising their hands. Who would share your smartphones? No one raises their hands. And so then I got, then it was my turn to speak. And I said, who of you has apps on your smartphones? And everyone raises their hands. I say, all of you are sharing your phones. You're sharing your location, your contacts, your data that you're putting in with intimately with different companies who are now collaborating. They're right on your asset that you've paid for, and they're right deep in your life. So this new way of collaborating and is really so pervasive in our life, we almost don't even notice it anymore.
And throughout the book, there are many, many examples of how this works. Now, I know that you don't like the word sharing economy. Why is that?
Sharing economy, a lot of people get quite upset about it. And when people think about it, they think of it as peer-to-peer and hard asset sharing, right? So we do think about Airbnb and Uber when we think of the sharing economy. And so a lot of people get hung up on the fact that, oh, it's money is changing hands, so it's not sharing. And I think, you can say that, but car sharing is absolutely sharing, and 40 people are sharing a single car. Like, there's nothing else you could call it, and money is changing hands. But my larger reason for not liking this term sharing economy is it has people thinking in this smaller way. And as I just explained, this movement is much larger than peer-to-peer sharing physical assets. So it's sharing all kinds of assets that aren't just physical, and it's not just between person to person. In the US is a company that I like called CClickFix, and you download the app on your phone, and when you see a pothole or a downed branch or trash that hasn't been picked up, you mark that location, and that piece of information gets sent directly into the municipal government, directly to the person who's in charge of trash collection, who's in charge of fixing potholes, and they repair it. And so that would be not peer-to-peer, but peer-to-government. And as I was talking about on our cell phones, we do peer-to-business all the time. And you do small business to big business, and you do government to government. That it's this new collaboration that we're really seeing of all kinds, where we're each in each other's business a lot more than we used to. If I go a step further. This book is called Peers, Inc., because what I really see happening is we have the opportunity for big companies to build platforms where they do all the things that only big companies can do, and they leave for other entities, the smaller ones, us, the peers, all the things that we're good at. So we, the peers, do the localization, customization, and specialization. So Uber drivers are now popping up in every little tiny location. And Airbnb, 6 months after Obama announced that we were going to normalize relationships with Cuba, there were 2,000 Airbnb listings in Cuba. So in this Peers Inc. collaboration, which is new and possible thanks to the internet, we have the peers who are providing this localization specialization, and the Inc. side, which is the government or the company or the institution, the larger entity, is doing all the things that require a big entity to do it. So they are building the fancy user interface, the insurance products that are overlaid, the same ways, the consistent ways of communicating, all of the hard work that an individual couldn't do. And so it's a totally new coupling. And when it's a labor platform, we now have enabled millions of micro entrepreneurs to do things that they never would have been able to do before. So people are given the power of the corporation, or when we work with using open data, we're getting the power of the government. Who else could collect that data at that scale? But we're now getting it for free and for very low cost and access to it in ways that were not possible before.
Now, the book is really a call to arms. What would you say is the essential message, the fundamental core of it?
The fundamental core is that business is completely transforming due to the internet and due to this new collaboration. If we think about industrial capitalism, which has been the last 150 years, the way that you would extract the most value out of any asset or any person was to make a very sharp delineation between what was in the corporation and what was outside the corporation. So we would have patents and copyrights and trademarks and certifications, and it was quite clear what was inside the company, and we would put everything inside that company. Conversely, today what's happening is because the internet exists and because we have the ability to network everything, the most value is extracted when things are shared, networked, and opened. So Airbnb, instead of building an entire hotel chain itself, is making more money faster because it has opened up its platform. So this is a profound shift in the way we think about using assets. I would say that more networked assets deliver more value than closed proprietary ones. And they deliver more value because they're more efficiently used, those assets, or brand new values extracted. More networked people are smarter, more innovative, more creative, more adaptive, more local than anybody inside a single organization or inside a government. And we've always known this to be true, but now that we can reach those people because they're networked, you must open up, otherwise you'll be slower, stupider, and less creative. So this opening up of assets and people is fundamentally and truly a way to get the most value out of everything we have. And it's appealing. What's striking to me as I think about this is if I'm a corporation, these companies grow fastest, learn fastest, and adapt fastest. And so once they start going, you can't catch them. And they will and are taking out companies in every single sector of the economy. And as an individual, it's incredibly compelling because when I contribute a few reservations a month to Zipcar, I personally have access to a fleet of 13,000 cars parked around the world. When I write 2 lines in Wikipedia, I personally have access to 4.8 million entries in the world's English encyclopedia. So when we have these shared networked assets, I always get more than I give. So there are these fundamental economic truths around this new way of organizing, this new collaboration, that are true. And so it's so compelling. It's so compelling from everyone's perspective that I have no doubt that we're definitely going towards this path.
Mm. You end the book with very inspiring words.
Oh, good. What were they?
About daring to be an individual, an entrepreneur, and a business person.
Yeah, one of the beauties around this new way. So I'm a mother of three. We started with that. So imagine when I first got my first job out of university. It was a miserable job. Then I hated it. But my mother said, good job. You got a job with benefits. And that was the most important thing. The fact that it was a soulless job or it was going to take me 5 or 6 years to figure out what I was good at was irrelevant because I had a job with benefits. In this new world where there's a peers in collaboration, where we are micro entrepreneurs and are given the power of the corporation or the power of the governments, where we are so empowered, we are able to do many things at the same time. To uncover, I think of my young children, my young adults, they're able to discover their passions at a much faster pace than we could before, and we really value individuals' diversity. So it's a totally different way of thinking about yourself in society, that the idea of being an automaton or having your boss choose you, you are able to choose your path. You are able to choose to work on the things that you're interested in a very powerful way. There's a lot of issues around labor, which we haven't discussed. So if we think of the last 100 years of industrialization, workplace rules, social safety nets, health has all been tied to full-time employment, except for in the UK. Not the U.S. has done that, and many places, countries have national health care. But it really was with the intention or the belief that all work was going to be full-time jobs. I heard the sentence, and I like it, that my father had one job in his lifetime, I'll have six jobs in my lifetime, and my children will have six jobs at the same time. And we are profoundly going in this direction as everything that can become a platform is going to become one, as all of labor is outsourced, but giving us a lot of flexibility. And we definitely need to rework our social contract, where we as countries have largely already decided that these are values that we care about, these social safety nets, and we need to decouple them from full-time labor and start having them available to everyone, whether or not they're doing six jobs or three jobs this month and seven jobs the next month. Mm-hmm. That we're all living very fluid lives, and those benefits need to also become more fluid. But as individuals, I think we are going to feel much more valued and more satisfied in our work because we will have much more control over it.
This is more than a book. It's become a movement, really. And it's a movement that you spearhead by flying around the world. You're talking in, I think you've lost count of how many places in how many different countries. But it's absolute groundswell of support. There are many, many people that believe that this is the way forward.
One of the things that's quite striking to me, and we see it playing out in the United States vividly, but I see it everywhere in the world, is after I give some talks and we have time for Q&A, I have been asking people, first I'd say I'm raising issues around the urgency of climate change and the pace with which we have to address it and the rising income inequality and the shakiness of the future of work. And so I've been asking people, it's a survey. So do you think on the one hand that we will see incumbent companies and governments evolving quickly enough to address these very key fundamental issues, or do you think they will be so slow that we will see a revolution of the people? And so the question is evolution or revolution? And really strikingly and shocking to me actually, is around the world, 70% of my audiences are voting revolution. And sometimes it really strikes me to my core in horror. I mean, revolution is 3 decades of economic unrest and a lot of suffering and a lot of death and a lot of chaos. That's really not what any of us would like to do. And so my own personal mission, and as I feel like most of us should be taking this up, that we need to speed the pace of evolution in our companies and in our governments to avoid revolution. And as I look at the Trump versus Bernie Sanders battle in the U.S., you can really feel this desire for very strong, strong change because government has been not responsive. But we really see it in every country. And then to qualify that a moment more, I don't think people are looking for revolution, but as they look at the governments that they know intimately or the companies that they work for, they do feel, wow, I don't see that evolution is going to happen fast enough. So I don't think they're voting for revolution so much as they're saying, I don't see the change happening. But this malaise that is around the world, I think, is really there in every single place I've been. I was recently in Seoul, and I've spoken several times in London, in the U.S., actually in Brussels. And when I ask a whole range of audiences, from CEOs of Fortune 500 companies to broad swaths of, I would still say, mostly educated people at large conferences, and I often also quiz my taxi drivers when I'm around, this underlying sense that things are really not right and we have to move things along is rising, and it is quite palpable. But to be inspiring, I really, what I really love about this new Peers Inc. collaboration is that it is something that we never could do before. We can have the best of all elements, and there's a place for all of us to play. So governments have their unique role doing things that no one smaller than that can do, and companies have their unique role, and individuals have their unique role. So it's a new place where each one of us have very special roles with our own special unique powers, and this alliance can scale exponentially and can learn exponentially and can have this hyper-local adaptation and experimentation. And those are the attributes we need to address climate, poverty, education. Anything that's dear to you can be moved quickly if we create organizations that have this shape.
And as you end the book, let's create the world we want to live in. Thank you very much indeed to Robin Chase. Peers Inc. is published by Headline and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to my producer Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website, from our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.